Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, I'm delighted to present to you once again, my scientific director, Megan Hall. Back when we first started working with clients, we ordered all the fancy tests for everyone who walked in the door. We tested the gut, not one but two tests, hormones, cortisol and organic acids to name a few. It got pretty expensive, but it seemed like the best way to figure out exactly what to do next. Our process has evolved over the years, and now we start with just a simple, inexpensive blood chemistry. This saves our clients a ton of time and money, and they still get great results. On the podcast today, MBT Scientific Director and Coach Megan Hall and I discuss the advanced and not so advanced biomedical tests we've run for clients over the years. We talk about the ones we still use and the ones we quit and why. Megan explains why you should be skeptical of genetic testing and the wealth of information you can derive from a basic blood chemistry. We also talk about bloodsmart.ai, the software we use at MBT to give personalized predictions of problems in your body that can help you decide on further testing and or actions you want to take. We also talk about some of the software improvements I've made recently. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where Megan answers your questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, as well as listen to all the replays covering everything from salt intake to infrared light. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to nbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's nbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's interview with Megan Hall. Well, Megan, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you, Chris?
I'm good. How is Cooper? You got to give us a Cooper update. It's become
Cooper's good.
A regular thing. He's good. No drama.
Yeah. Well, he got stung by a bee. That was the latest drama. Oh. And one side of his face swelled up, but he's fine. And he learned to swim a couple weeks ago. So that was really exciting.
Okay.
I felt like a proud parent on the side of the bank, just kind of cheering for him.
They're obviously good water dogs. Labs are obviously good in the water. How did it go down? I can tell you how it went down with Tiger, my second dog. Kipper was a little bit more cautious, but Tiger, he's a dog of very little brains. And he learned to swim in the deep end, right? Actually, he just like ran off a jetty into the water and just started swimming. I'm like, huh, I guess they could just do it. They don't need to learn. But how did it go down with Cooper?
Yeah, so I mean, Cooper had kind of like, we were at the dog park and he kind of had followed some dogs into the water, but hadn't like gone deep enough to where he was actually swimming. And so one day it was almost like he had to get away from the other dogs so they weren't like distracting him, because he just wants to play with them. And so through the stick, he went out and he did a little splashing. So he's getting better at the splashing versus actually swimming gently. But yeah, he loves it.
That's great.
So it's a lot
of fun. That's great.
And it's great because it tires him out. More than anything, it tires him out.
That's fantastic. Excellent. Well, let's talk about testing.
I thought this would be,
you know, MBT's been around a while now. Can't believe I'm saying that. This is like the longest job I've ever had in my entire career. And so...
What year did you start it?
It was 2012, I want to say. When MBT really started coming to be. And then I was thinking about this the other day. It was the Ancestral Health Symposium in 2013 was when the podcast really got going, because I just asked a bunch of people at HS if they wanted to be on my podcast and they all said yes. I couldn't believe it. I walked up to Dominic D'Agostino and said, hey, great talk. Would you like to be on my podcast? He said, sure. Like, how many years ago is that now? Like, how many podcasts has Dominic D'Agostino done since then?
Oh, that's funny.
It's been a while. And so we've seen a lot of things come and go. You know, I did a bunch of training courses shortly after quitting my job at the hedge fund. And they were all quite similar. And they all taught you to interpret some tests that we don't use at all now. In fact, I think some of the companies have gone out of business. You know, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about some of the things that have come and gone and why they came and went. And what we can learn from that. And as always, Megan, you put together a fantastic outline. And I'll be sure to link that from the show notes you can find over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcasts. Or if you poke around in your podcast app, you'll surely find the show notes and you'll find everything, including the outline that we're using for this interview. Link from there. So let's talk about what we did in the early days. We used to do a lot more testing, I would say, when we began working with a client.
Yeah, absolutely. So we used to run all of the tests in the beginning, and there was a handful. So the tests that we used to run included two different stool tests. So we ran, it was typically the GI map in doctor's data. So one was more DNA PCR based, one was more culture based. So the two stool tests, the Dutch test looking at hormones, cortisol, looking an organic acid test, and then a very comprehensive blood panel. And over the years, we've kind of whittled that down into the basic markers. All of these tests are quite expensive. So we're talking $200 to $500 per test. And doing them all up front costs quite a bit of money. And then people, of course, would want to retest them. And that would also cost money. I would also say that many of the clients that we were working with, especially at the time that that was the business model, they wanted to do all the tests. So I think a lot of people are attracted to MBT, who are attracted to MBT are very data-driven, which can be a really good thing sometimes because it makes us really comprehensive and gives us a good baseline. But then it can also be a not so good thing if the data drives you to treat the test results and not the person.
That's a really good point. And you've just reminded me that that was my bias, right? Like I'd gone to some functional medicine doctor and they'd ordered all these fancy tests and they put in a lot of work into interpreting them. And the intervention was clearly highly customized. And that was what I was craving for. I'd already been to a conventional primary care doctor and specialists, and they had ordered labs that I didn't understand and didn't know how to interpret. And that was one of my frustrations, was I could see how long they were spending on the interpretation because I've sat on the other side of the desk where they did it, right? Like there was just a kind of, you scan from top to bottom and you're looking for something that side of the normal range. And if not, then they just move on. And as an engineer, I'm sat there thinking, there's a ton of information there that you're not bothering to look at. Like, why can't I don't know how to do it. Like you've got an entire education that I need to catch up on before I could do that. And so that was my bias. And of course, the tests are expensive, you know, the fancy stool tests and the saliva hormone tests and all this stuff that you just mentioned. But the transformation in the way that I felt was so incredible. And I'd already spent a lot of money on deductibles, right? I had fancy PPO insurance and I'd already spent a lot of money. And so that kind of anchored me price-wise on the cost of the fancy lab test. But I mean, after you've done it and you've done the intervention and you feel so much better, your motivation for retesting really goes away. I think I redid one of the stool tests because it found a pinworm, like in the old days, the Genova GI effects. Back then, it was run by a lab called Metametrics, and Genova acquired it. And they did PCR testing for a bunch of worms. And the intervention was a deworming pill I got from my conventional doctor. And it was like an overnight transformation. Those deworming pills were amazing. So I redid that test just to make sure that the worm was gone. But I don't think I really did any of the other tests afterwards on myself. But we did end up using them in our practice. And of course, that was why people came to us. We did the Ben Greenfield podcast. I say we, Jamie, my co-founder, and I did the Ben Greenfield podcast back in like 2013 or something. And I explained what had happened to me. And a bunch of people came forward and they said, you know what, I want to do exactly that. Just like, here's my credit card number. Just send me all the tests. Tell me about the dietary intervention. I want, that is exactly the problem I had. Please give me whatever it was that you did to solve all those problems. And so that was the genesis of MBT. And that's kind of how we got into selling all these tests in the beginning. I think we did some good work, but with hindsight, I think we could have been more efficient, right?
Yeah, I think so too. And I actually remember the first time I heard that podcast. I was in college. I must have been my second or third year. I was lifting in the gym. I used to listen to podcasts while I worked out. So I remember the first time I heard you on a podcast.
That's funny. I'd probably cringe, wouldn't I, if I were to go back and listen to that now. Although some of the later ones, I did one with Ben on organic acids testing and another on the Dutch test. And a lot of careful preparation went into those interviews. And I remember, I mean, it was fun, right? Do you remember that Ben had super high cortisol and we were trying to figure it out? And, you know, I had help from a bunch of experts who went pretty deep into the literature. And I was just like the guy that showed up standing on the shoulders of giants and presented all this pretty good information that I think was quite helpful. I never did find out whether Ben got to the bottom of his high cortisol problem. I should ask him that because I'm still in touch.
Yeah, you should. That'd be interesting. I wanted to like briefly talk about gut tests because there's a lot of gut tests out there. We've been through the gamut of running different gut tests at MBT. And I honestly go back and forth between which one is best, if there even is a best one, and whether or not to even bother testing in certain cases. So in the past, we've run the GI map test by Diagnostic Solutions. We've run doctor's data tests. We've run Genova, GIFX panels, Ubiome. We've run gut bio by Longevity. We've run SIBO breath tests. And certainly there are many more gut tests out there, but certain markers, say for example, calprotectin, have a certain amount of unreliability from test to test, even if you do duplicate samples. And I think Lucy Mailing has talked about that on the podcast before. Right. So that's something to keep in mind with the gut test. And then also sometimes the results will change the intervention. So for example, if somebody has H. pylori versus if they don't, and sometimes or oftentimes the results may not actually change the intervention. So I think it's important to remember, especially with the gut tests, but also all tests in general, to really treat the client and not just the results. Should we talk a little bit about hormone testing, Chris?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I am very grateful. I should say that Lucy Mailing in particular has been really good in elucidating why some of these tests are useful. It's in particular the stool culture, the traditional stool culture that appears on the top of the doctor's data test. Do you know if they're still doing that? I know that test has changed a lot in the last few months even.
Yeah,
so I'm not sure if they're still doing it.
I think they still do a part of it culture, but it's not the whole test anymore.
Yeah, and it's so hard. Like, it just requires all this thinking in shades of gray because they do really good parasitology. And I remember once we found an Entamoeba histolytica parasitic infection using the doctor's data test, and they're using a microscope in the way that you might think in a lab. And, you know, that's a life-changing finding for a client. And just because the stool culture at the top is completely worthless, like that parasitology like really helps someone, you know? So you have to be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, I agree. So what about hormone tests should we talk about, Chris, first?
Yeah. So, you know, a couple of the training courses that I did back in 2012 or something, they were like really big into these saliva hormone tests. And, you know, I like to think that I come to everything with a certain degree of skepticism, but I try not to be cynical. And, you know, I was like, you know, I don't really know about this. And I feel like I should, you know, do a little bit of reading around it, something other than the training course itself. And so I found Robert Sapolsky's book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, that I would still recommend to anyone to this day, is a fabulous book. And I think it's been heavily revised since I read it maybe 10 years ago. And you could also read Behave. Is also, I think most of what's in Zebras is also in Behave by the same author. Very, very good. And Sapolsky talked about the problem of chronic stress. It's like a big, big problem. I thought, yeah, you know what? I think they're right to be worrying about cortisol and chronic stress in these training programs. And so I bought into it and we started running these labs. But still, I had this reservation because they were teaching this model of adrenal fatigue that was popularized by a scientist called Hans Selye. And even right there in the book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, Sapolsky describes the answer that Selye came up that was sufficiently wrong that it's generally thought to have cost him the Nobel Prize for all his other work. You know, like, so I read that back in, you know, 2010 or something. I was like, huh, like that's funny. They're still teaching this three-stage adrenal fatigue thing, you know, with supplements to go with each stage. And it feels like it's customized because of that. But hang on a minute. Sapolsky said that he almost lost the, well, thought to have lost the Nobel Prize for like teaching this stuff. Like, is it right? Like, I probably... But then eventually you find out through trial and error, you know, like you recommend the licorice root and the pregnenolone or whatever the hell it is. And you realize it doesn't really work, right? You just figure it out from trial and error. And you also see how quickly it can change. And maybe we'll get into this a little bit, you know, like cortisol, I think it's part of the immune system. And if there's something going on with your immune system, that can change very quickly. And the cortisol will just change very quickly with it. And it's nothing to do with how much licorice or pregnenolone you took. But yeah, I put my hands up. I'm sorry. I fell for that one for a while. But it's been, how long has it been since we've done a saliva hormone test, Megan?
Not since I've been at MBT.
So at least a couple
people
of years.
People come to us with salivary hormone tests and I say, that's nice. And I put it aside.
Okay. Okay. So you didn't even, how did you know that to begin with? Like, had you already figured it out before you even started working with MBT that these saliva hormone tests weren't very useful?
Yeah. I looked in the literature because I was a little bit skeptical. And sometimes for some things, they do use salivary hormones for research purposes. But if we want to go with the gold standard, you look in blood. Dutch tests can sometimes be helpful. But yeah, I was always just a little bit skeptical of the salivary hormones. And they only look at, like if we're looking at cortisol, it's only free cortisol that's looked at. It's not your total cortisol. So you don't get the whole picture.
Right. Exactly. And it's not like we didn't find low cortisol. Good grief did we find low cortisol in almost every single client that we tested, myself included. But the problem is not the low cortisol itself. That's really the passenger and not the driver, to use that same metaphor that we used last time when we talked about PhenoAge. And Sapolsky says it really well here. It's not that the army runs out of bullets. Instead, the body spends so much on the defense budget that it neglects education and healthcare and social services, right? So that's what cortisol is. It's like liquidating assets. And if you keep liquidating your assets, then eventually you're going to go bust, right? But if you're running from a lion, then you got to liquidate your assets and hope that you survive the day. Saliva hormone testing it's kind of not really a thing anymore anyway, but just be aware of that. You know, if like you ever find someone that's selling those, I don't think really we should be doing those anymore.
Yeah, I agree. And the Dutch test has been a little bit helpful, mostly for like looking at cortisol disruptions throughout the day, so circadian abnormalities. And I do also think that in certain cases, looking at hormones on the Dutch test, and maybe this is more the case for women that I found versus men, but sometimes looking at those hormones can be helpful. But that's largely when unexplainable symptoms are still present and we've already tackled all of the other low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, you could say this is true of the saliva testing too, but the Dutch is super good for finding people that with a flipped circadian rhythm, which I remember was pretty common. That again can be a life-changing finding for a client. If you're walking around and your cortisol's high at night and low during the day, then that's not going to feel good. And it's definitely worthy of a conversation about entraining circadian rhythm. And we've talked a lot about that on the podcast before, especially with Greg Potter and Sachin Panda and Bill Dagakos have all been really good on those topics.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I wanted to mention is that testing just in general can be unnecessary and even productive at times. So for example, you know, if we're going off of the salivary hormone example, if you run a salivary cortisol test that comes back sky high and you think the person has very high cortisol for some reason, and then you start digging in to that and adding supplements and adaptogens to bring cortisol down. But like I said, salivary only is looking at free cortisol, so it's only part of the picture. And I've seen, you know, on like the Dutch test, many times free cortisol normal or even high, whereas, you know, total cortisol output is low. And that doesn't always, in fact, rarely never, it doesn't always mean that you need to directly treat the elevated cortisol, because what you might do could be counterproductive if total cortisol is actually low. So free cortisol being high could be due to something like hypothyroidism, which you can miss if you're only testing saliva and not looking at, you know, the patient's history, their symptoms, and other test results. So you really do have to, I think, take everything in as much context as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that's the art and craft of what you do, is integrating all of that, the history, the symptoms, plus the test results. It's tricky.
Yeah, absolutely. And another example of like how testing can be unproductive is if you run a gut test and the person has zero gut issues. This came up a lot when we were, again, like I said, running all of these tests in the beginning for everyone, whether or not they had certain particular symptoms. So if you run a test, somebody has no gut issues, either direct or indirect. So direct gut symptoms would be, you know, constipation, diarrhea, gas, bloating. Indirect symptoms could be something like skin issues or brain fog, something that's like connected to the gut, but not directly related to it. So you run this test, you see something like blastocystis hominis pop up on a stool test, and the client becomes very concerned because it's a parasitic pathogen. Or, you know, I should actually say potentially parasitic pathogen. So especially if the person is asymptomatic, that blasto you found is probably the subtype that's commensal, whereas certain subtypes are actually pathogenic. Or, for example, sometimes you see a low or high bacteroides to firmicutes ratio, and you try to micromanage that, and the literature around whether or not that ratio actually matters is quite controversial. And from what I've read and what I've seen, it's probably not very important, at least in most cases. So those are some examples of how testing can be really unproductive at times. And genetic testing is definitely another area where testing can be unnecessary and often counterproductive. So do you want to rant a little bit about genetic testing, Chris?
Sure. Yeah, so this was another test that I was kind of vaguely familiar with, because I was on the road to a diagnosis of celiac disease, and I never really got there, because somewhere along the line, you figure out what the problem is, right? And then you stop eating and stop it. You know, like it's so bad that you do just stop eating bread in particular, and then you're not going to get the diagnosis anymore, because to get the diagnosis requires that you're eating the thing that's causing the problem. But yeah, part of the diagnosis was a genotype test. They look for the HLA genotype that's, I think it's there in all celiacs, and I did have the genotype. So I was kind of vaguely familiar. I was like trying to understand what the hell is this HLA genotype, and that got me into a sort of a basic understanding of what genetics is, very, very basic. And I immediately realized that this couldn't be the whole answer, because the genetic information was somewhat analogous to source code. And I'm a software engineer and I get source code, right? And so when you know the source code, you don't know much, right? Like you know something, but you can't possibly tell what the behavior of this software will be at runtime, given the code alone. And I think we can extend Josh's How to Win Angry Birds analogy here. So imagine the game of Angry Birds. And I think most people listening to this will have seen the game of Angry Birds. But imagine any computer game, right? So Imagine I give you the source code for that computer game. And then I ask you, what will the game that gets played look like? What would a video record? What would a screencast record so that I can upload that onto YouTube so that other people can see how the game is played? And having the source code alone would tell you almost nothing about what game will be played, right? Like you know that there'll be Angry Birds involved and at the end there'll be a score, but that's about it. You can't tell what exact game will be played. Like there's there's an infinite number of games that can be played given this source code. And really it just comes down to the environment. That is the inputs that the player makes on the keyboard or the touchpad or whatever it is. And so that's why you're here listening to this podcast, is to learn how to win at the game of Angry Birds, right? And knowing the source code for it isn't going to help you very much. And even if it did help you, I think the accuracy of some of the direct-to-consumer genetic testing is very best questionable. And I can link to a study in the show notes. Our analysis indicated that 40% of variants in a variety of genes reported on direct-to-consumer raw data were false positives. 40% false positive rate for direct-to-consumer testing. So even if it did tell you something, like the test is not accurate anyway.
Did I ever tell you, Chris, that I ran my 23andMe data or something through Prometheus way back when, years ago, and it told me I was at very high risk for prostate cancer. And it was at that point where I just said, nope, this is complete BS.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I never really fell for this one, but I did entertain the idea for a while. I went to a couple of conferences, I did some training courses and whatnot. And the reason I did it was because it was really about the people who were teaching this stuff. I respected them. I thought they were doing good work. There was a lot of evidence they were doing good work. Other practitioners were there and they were learning it. And I think those practitioners were also doing good work. I don't think I've ever met a practitioner that's not doing excellent work. But yeah, some of this stuff is just completely erroneous and not terribly useful. It's just a distraction. But you know, if anyone wants to get up to speed on this stuff really quickly, my first recommendation would be to read chapter 8 in Robert Sapolsky's book, Behave. And the chapter is called Do Genes Know What They're Doing? And the second part of the title is The Triumph of the Environment. It kind of tells you everything you need to know. And in that chapter, Sapolsky very elegantly describes how 95% of the genome is non-coding. So imagine that 95 of the material that's there in the genome doesn't code for anything, apparently. Ostensibly doesn't code for anything. But what it really encodes for are all the non-linearities, like transcription factors. So if you're a software engineer, you'll understand that code has if-then-else clauses in it. And that's what the 95% does. And that really tells you everything you need to know. Because obviously, in a system where 95% of the information is non-coding or an if-then-else clause, then the environment is going to be way more important than the genetic material itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think, just kind of to go back to practitioners who were doing good work, who we respect, it's unfortunate that well-respected practitioners and people that people really look up to are calling particular genotypes things like dirty, not to throw anyone under the bus. But that really does kind of put a negative spin on your genes when really it's the environment that we should be focusing on.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen this time and time again. The metacognition, how you think about things, is more important than the thing itself. So thinking you have the warrior gene is probably more important than having the warrior gene. Thinking that you are a strength-based athlete when you would like to do endurance activities because of the results of your DNA fit test is probably more important than the result itself. Thinking that you have the MTHFR disease is more important than MTHFR itself. So you have to be really careful about running and interpreting these tests, because there's basically no useful information there whatsoever. The stool testing, it's complicated. Hormone testing in blood, saliva, and urine, it's complicated. Genetic testing just needs to be cancelled. Like, this is the, you know, cancel culture is the norm now. Can we just cancel genetic testing?
Yeah, I largely agree. So this kind of brings us to a good place to talk about the growth mindset.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you can explain it, because I'm worried about mucking it up.
Okay. So, and I really do think that, you know, the growth mindset can come in anywhere in this discussion about testing, but I think that it is an important piece of the genetic testing conversation as well. So for those who aren't familiar with the growth mindset, I would stop listening to this podcast right now. Go read Carol Dweck's book called Mindset. And it's come up in many of our podcasts before. And thank you to Simon Marshall for the recommendation.
I did a podcast with Simon on the growth mindset as well.
Yeah, we'll link to that in the show notes. So for people who aren't aware of these, there's two mindsets that Carol Dweck writes about. So there's the fixed mindset that tells us that intelligence, personality, character, and other personal qualities are static and unable to be changed. And basically, you're stuck with what you've got. You're doomed if you don't like it. And as a result of that way of thinking, many people achieve less than their full potential in life. And this kind of deterministic view of the world is, at least in my mind, a very depressing way to think. And then on the other hand, you have the growth mindset, which tells us that intelligence, character, and other personal qualities can be developed and honed over time. And ultimately, this fosters in people a desire to learn, a desire to become better, and results in them reaching a higher levels of achievement in life. And in my mind, this is definitely the mindset you want to live with, especially, you know, when we're having this conversation about testing, genetic testing. As Chris just mentioned, if you think you have certain genetic polymorphisms, thinking that is probably more powerful than actually having them. MTHFR, if you know you have that polymorphism, you may think if you have a fixed mindset that you'll be doomed to a life of elevated homocysteine and a myriad of other issues. And then you've really got to work on turning that fixed mindset around genetics into a growth mindset. And some people, I will say, they have a fixed mindset, say, about genetics, but maybe they have a growth mindset in another area of life. And another example is, like you said, Chris, if you have the warrior gene, then you may automatically start manifesting some particular traits, even though you didn't actually have them before.
Yeah, I think the distinction is easy to make with simple questions like, do you believe that people are born mathematicians or are they made mathematicians, right? And usually what you find is that it depends. But people will say that, so I've just been spent a month living with Jeff Candleweed and he does stuff on the bike that I can't really even dream about. And was he born able to do that stuff on the bike or did he learn how to do it with lots of deliberate practice? And of course, the answer is he learned how to do it. And it's the same answer over and over again. Are people born musicians or do they become musicians with lots of careful and deliberate practice? And where it gets complicated is because we're not trying to totally write off the potential. We're not trying to totally write off talent altogether. Clearly, Jeff has some degree of innate talent. It's just that it's still the deliberate hard work that makes up most of what you see on the trail. And I've been doing this group program with Simon just recently, and he's been helping a group of about 15 of us with our mental resilience. And Simon has been citing some of the work of Andrew D. Huberman. And it turns out I'd not heard of him until Simon mentioned him. And then when I Googled the guy, it seems like he's all over the internet in ways I couldn't possibly imagine. He's been on Joe Rogan. He's been on Rich Roll's podcast. He teaches neuroscience on Instagram every day. I'd highly recommend checking him out. But anyway, it would seem now that the neuroscience is catching up with Carol Dweck's original findings in its experimental psychology. And basically, the neuroscience explains the agitation and discomfort you feel when you're trying to begin something, or I think when you notice you're wrong, right? So this applies to us with this testing. It's like, wow, you know, we've run 1,500 of these saliva tests and I think it's rubbish. You know, like everybody notices when they're wrong. Everybody notices that it's hard when you're trying to begin a new task. The difference between the fixed and the growth mindset is the fixed people quit or they dig in and they rationalize, whereas the growth mindset people, they realize that this is the path to greatness and that if they just continue, then the good feelings will come later, right? So it's behavior first and then thoughts and feelings later. In the beginning, you just need to commit to the behavior and then trust that pleasure, the good thoughts and feelings will come later.
Yeah, absolutely. And being able to admit and acknowledge when you're wrong. Because, for example, if we didn't do that, if we had continued running genetic testing and all of this stuff and really promoting it to our clients, then that's doing them a disservice.
Right. And then, you know, one common way that we've seen of people like rationalizing and double downing is to make things more complicated. You know, it's like in the beginning, we said that it was total cholesterol that caused cardiovascular disease. Well, no, sorry about that. It's like it's the good cholesterol and there's a bad cholesterol. Oh, no, sorry. Like, I guess that doesn't really, there's no signal there either. Well, now we have to do this fancy fractionated lipid panel with all these different particles on it. And that's what causes cardiac. Like, come on. Like, can you not just like put your hand up and say there's not really a signal here and come up with a completely different and correct answer?
Yeah, for sure. I guess the next test is, as long as you don't have anything else to talk about as far as genetics go, Chris, would be GlycoMark, which we ran for a little bit of time. And then I think just based off of the kind of like the false positive results we were getting with our client base, we stopped measuring it.
Yeah, I wanted to say something about GlycoMark because we talked a lot about GlycoMark on the podcast a couple of years ago. And I can tell you it's turned out to be a completely useless biomarker. The potential is very interesting. GlycoMark is a trade name. The molecule is called 1,5-anhydroglucosidyl. It comes in the diet. And when glucose is high, you pee out the 1,5-anhydroglucosidyl. So in theory, it's a marker of glucose variability, and it does correlate, it predicts cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality. Now, the problem is, everybody listening to this podcast is, I think, and this is kind of me theorizing, is they're not eating anything with the 1,5-anhydroglucosidyl in it. And in particular, they're not eating soy. I found some very old studies that showed that soy is the primary source of 1,5-anhydroglucosidyl. And this makes total sense. It was a biomarker that was originally developed in Japan, I understand. And probably that's not a limitation because everybody's eating soy there. One would assume, maybe someone listening will correct me if I'm wrong. But what we found when working with clients is glycomark is universally low and it is a useless biomarker for understanding glycemic variability. And the thing to do instead, and maybe we'll get into this in a bit more detail later, is continuous glucose monitoring, which is now available direct to consumer through NutriSense. I did an interview with Cara Collier. You can listen to that. I think that other companies doing much the same, I think one's called Levels, are available.
Yeah, I've definitely seen low glycomark in many of our clients when we used to run it with very good glycemic control. And they're definitely not getting those blood glucose excursions above 180, which is typically what glycomark is looking at.
Right. And I mean, it's the same as the genetic testing. I mean, you tell me, Megan, how many times have you had to talk somebody off the ledge about the genetic result or about the glycomark? You think, well, this is terrible. My glucose is obviously regularly going over 180 because here's the objective evidence right here in front of us. Look, my glycomark is low. And then you have to spend half an hour on the phone with the client explaining to them that it's just a false positive and that the glycemic variability is probably fine.
Yeah, all the time. And I do think that glycomark, maybe in a different population, has
right
a better outcome as far as, you know, it actually being low and suggesting something. But yeah, in our client population, it's typically not a useful marker to run.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, so maybe you're a practitioner and you're working with a bunch of people who are eating a standard American diet that includes soy or whatever else 1,5-anhydroglucosidyl is in, and then it might be a useful biomarker. But I'm guessing that you could just eyeball somebody's food log and tell them what the glycemic variability is going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And this is a little bit off topic, but it's about glycomark. The other day, I came across a study. Maybe we can throw it in the show notes if you want. But I think it was published last year, and it showed that salivary, so not blood, but salivary 1,5-anhydroglucosidyl was inversely related to dental caries risk in children, which in my mind isn't that surprising because we know that processed high carbohydrate foods that are largely responsible for these blood glucose excursions and many people are also risk factors for dental caries and cavities, and that dental and metabolic health are definitely connected. But I just thought that was interesting.
It is interesting.
So anything else we want to say about like previous testing, or should we go to kind of what we're doing presently?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to transition to what we're doing right now. What stood the test of time?
Yeah, absolutely. And before we do that, I just want to say a lot of times I talk to people about what their, where do your resources stand? So oftentimes, you know, the answer about whether or not to run a bunch of fancy tests is kind of, you know, one, what are your symptoms, health history, overall goals, but also where your resources lie. So for example, well, and also if the test is even worth running. But I think starting with basic blood chemistry, which we'll talk about in a minute, is kind of the way to go. Looking at health history, doing a comprehensive symptom analysis. But then also, you know, as far as the fancy test goes, if you're time rich, money poor, meaning you have a lot of time, you don't want to spend a lot of money on these testing, expensive tests, then that's typically the case where we'll just do a basic blood chemistry panel that costs something like, I don't know, $70, and do a comprehensive health history, which we do with everyone anyway. And then we'll kind of figure out where to go from there with lifestyle interventions, supplements, dietary shifts, and really only consider like the fancy testing if we really need to down the road. You can get a lot of good information from a blood chemistry, which we'll talk about in a minute. But then there are just like a handful of people who are money rich and time poor. So maybe these are more the people who we started working with at the beginning. So this might be, you know, a CEO of a company who's very busy and has the resources to put into testing up front and doesn't really have the time or the energy or desire to spend time tinkering with interventions that could work, but that aren't as targeted. So in this case, maybe we'll go ahead and do some of the expensive fancy tests up front. But I would always keep in mind that no test is perfect and we always treat the person before treating the test result. And especially if people aren't already doing those kind of quadrant one low-hanging fruit interventions, then I typically recommend against doing these fancy tests.
Yes, an excellent point. And you're right. If someone's cash rich and time poor, you might argue, well, they should just do all the tests because it takes time for the results to come back. I don't want to string this out over 6 months as we go from one test to the other. Why not just do them all at once? And that's a fair argument if your psychology is utterly bulletproof, right? If you can look at the results of a meaningless test and admit, really subconsciously admit that it is meaningless, right? Like the warrior gene thing. Like, I mean, I guess we're not going to order that, but there probably is going to be, if you do all of the tests at once, you are definitely going to get at least one finding that's bogus and that you're going to have to ignore, like really ignore. And yeah. So you have to be cash rich, time poor, and have really good psychology, which is really hard, especially right now.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And then there's, you know, third group of people who are kind of somewhere in the middle. And this is probably most people, where most people end up. So maybe they don't want to spend $2,000 on testing, but they also have like an overt symptom that they really want a specific test and that warrants a specific test. So in this case, maybe we do that initial blood chemistry, symptom history analysis, and then maybe something like a stool test. And then we work from there. But before we talk about fancy tests, I do think that, like I mentioned, I just want to reiterate, everyone should be focusing on quadrant one intervention. So if you're not sleeping, if you're not eating a nutrient-dense whole foods diet, then we need to talk about those interventions before.
But for the practitioners listening, you've got a problem because I'm guessing that most of the clients or patients that come to you, they've already done that, right? Like I listened to a bunch of podcasts and they talked about that whole foods diet and this other guy talked about the importance of sleep, and I didn't know about that. And so I tried those things, and you know what? They were right. And I've heard you talking about those things too. And so maybe you're the person that's going to find me the last 20%. And I think for those practitioners, they're in a tough spot because they can't just say, well, you just need to diet harder. You just need to sleep a bit harder. It's unlikely that like one tiny thing, like, oh, maybe you should just do guided meditation is like going to be the thing that gets that client the last 20%, if they're walking around with an iron overload or something like that, you know, like something that you're only going to find by looking inside of the client and doing some testing. And for those people, there's absolutely no doubt that blood chemistry is the least expensive, most insightful, widely available, scientifically validated, and underutilized test in the integrative health space. And it's really been helping us and other BloodSmart.ai users get clients by lowering the cost and the barriers to entry for working with us. And we couldn't possibly justify running any of the tests that we've mentioned thus far until we've done a blood chemistry and run it through our algorithmic software. When I talk to practitioners now, it seems that's the number one thing that they're struggling with is they can get people in the door, but then once they're in the door, how do you sell them on your services? And the main barrier to entry is the cost of working with you. And much of that cost is the cost of testing. So you're effectively working as an unpaid salesman for these testing companies who are doing a lot of really expensive mass spectrometry. And that makes it super risky for the client. They don't know what's on the other side of working with you. And once they find out, if it turns out all the tests were useless, which is probably not going to happen, but it's not impossible, at least not in the client's mind, then you can't really give them their money back for all that expensive mass spectrometry. And so doing a $71 blood chemistry vastly lowers the risk to the potential client and thus makes it much easier to get clients. So I would encourage any practitioner listening to start with a basic blood chemistry.
Absolutely. I would agree. And just looking at basic blood biomarkers, if you know what you're doing and what the biomarkers actually mean, if you can get some critical thinking in there, that can give you a lot of information about what's going on physiologically under the hood for a client or a patient. And even something like MCV, even if it doesn't tell you exactly, you know, that you have a B12 versus folate deficiency versus maybe it's alcohol related, it can at least start a conversation. So do you eat B12 rich foods? Do you drink excessive amounts of alcohol? Do you have symptoms of low stomach acid, which is needed for B12 absorption? So I think that blood chemistry is an invaluable tool for all practitioners. And the basic panel that we typically run is just a complete blood count with differential, a CMP or a comprehensive metabolic profile, an iron panel, and then a lipid panel. So very simple test that most practitioners or doctors are already running. And then after testing those and after asking additional questions, those might come up and warrant further blood testing. So other helpful markers that we occasionally run, again, like after we run those basic markers, would include things like zinc and copper, vitamin D, reticulocytes, homocysteine, C-reactive protein, C-peptide, hemoglobin A1C, and even those aren't like perfect. a complete thyroid panel with antibodies. And some people, again, we're not just going to run a thyroid panel on everybody, but looking at to see kind of where their symptoms stand. Advanced lipids, Chris, you mentioned this before, and some people really like to look at advanced lipids, especially if they're...
You know, you heard something on a podcast talking about advanced lipids, how that you had to do this advanced lipids thing in order to know your risk, and that the traditional lipid panels were rubbish. And, you know, I really want to do this advanced... I mean, sure, you want to do the advanced lipid panel, I'll order it for you. No problem. You can order it for yourself, you know. I'll place the order for you if you want, but how much you're going to learn about your cardiovascular disease risk from that information, I'm really not sure about at all.
Yeah, exactly. If something's way out of range and you also have these other markers, inflammatory markers out of range, sure. But I never get too excited about these advanced lipid panels, but I am willing to look at results if people really want to. And then the coronary artery calcium scan is probably one of, if not the test to run if people are really concerned about their cardiovascular disease risk, because it looks directly at coronary artery calcification. So it's looking at the disease process.
Yeah, I think Ivor Cummins has been super good on this and on this podcast. And, you know, I'd note with interest that Malcolm Kendrick is not really a fan of the coronary artery calcium scan, because, and this is an important question to ask with every tester, what are you going to do with that result, right? If you're eating your low carb, high fat, healthy lifestyle, and you're exercising and you're sleeping and you're managing stress well, and you've got a bunch of really great social connections, and the score comes back and it's horrible, what are you going to do? Are you going to go on a raw vegan diet to see if you can fix that? I don't think so. I hope not too. But my point is that you're not going to do anything with the results of this test. So why are you doing it? It doesn't make any sense. If you've got no plans, no intention of changing anything. I sort of see Malcolm's point like that. But Ivor would probably say what gets measured gets managed, right? Like you have to, and at some point, if the score is horrible, then you have to get an interventional cardiologist involved. There's like stuff you can do. Obviously, it becomes a more of a medical thing rather than a health optimization thing. But yeah, I've done this coronary artery calcium scan, and thankfully mine was a zero score. But really, it's the progression over time that you care about. And we can link to some really useful resources on that. It's been on the forum, and Ivor's been super good on that. So we'll link to those resources in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that, you know, if you just get one scan score, that's not going to be much helpful or very helpful. But if it's the serial measures over time. So if you're looking at how it's changing and progressing, I think that can be helpful for some people. Not everyone, depends on the population. But and then sex hormones for both males and females are another thing that we sometimes run in blood. For a cycling female, you do want to make sure that you test hormones and ideally probably everything else in blood chemistry for that matter at the same time of the month, because changes in estrogen and progesterone can change your insulin sensitivity and all of these other things. And you also typically, if you're looking at hormones, you want to kind of test when progesterone is at its peak, which would be around days 19 to 22, depending on the length of the cycle. And then with blood chemistry, there are some other things to consider kind of leading up to the test. So there's hydration. Hydration status can absolutely affect some of the markers like BUN and albumin, and some other markers as well, like electrolytes and hemoglobin, hematocrit. Muscle catabolism from exercise. So there's an argument for just doing your hard workout if that's what you do every day and that's kind of your norm. But it does add a confounding variable for things like the liver function test, so ALT and AST. So I personally like people to abstain from hard exercise in the 48 hours before the blood draw. I think that gentle kind of low intensity exercise or movement is usually fine depending on the person's definition of low intensity. And then fasting status. So our optimal ranges are based off of fasting levels. So if you do take a test in that postprandial window, there will definitely be some markers that look off, like potentially triglycerides or glucose, but that's just normal physiology. And then I also think that there is a lot of power in tracking over time, which through Chris's programming skills has made possible with BloodSmart. So, you know, you can track your scores over time. So your wellness score, your PhenoAge score, you can track the individual markers over time. I think it is nice to track the markers over time because there can be some variability test to test. But if you get this big swing in one direction, especially if that correlates with changes in clinical signs or symptoms, then that might be something to dig a little bit deeper into.
Yeah. So for people that are not familiar, BloodSmart.ai is the software that we use at MBT. And one of the core value propositions is that I can predict the results of a test that someone like you already did using supervised machine learning. So we've got large data sets that include test results from a variety of different people. And what the supervised machine learning does is it takes the results that you just gave me, the test that you did yesterday, and it finds someone most like you in the training data, and then gives you the result for that person. So let's say that you're interested in predicting your blood level of lead, right? You just did a basic $71 chemistry and you would like to know your blood level of lead. Well, I can use supervised machine learning to find someone like you in the training data who also ran blood levels of lead. And so I can predict your blood levels of lead. And what this does is, again, it greatly reduces the cost of testing because now I don't need to run all the tests. And I've just given you one example, lead, but we can predict the results of all kinds of tests, including toxic exposures, heavy metals, endocrine disruptors, other environmental pollutants, vitamin deficiencies, including vitamin D, selenium, folate, zinc, copper, B12. Some of the hormones that Megan just mentioned, including thyroid, cortisol, estrogen, testosterone, metabolic health, including insulin, homocysteine. We've got a fatty liver index and atherogenic index of plasma, inflammation, including high sensitivity C-reactive protein. I can also predict telomere length, grip strength, and last but not least, pregnancy. The models are pretty damn accurate. And the reason I know that is because I use K-fold cross-validation to hold out some of the data and test the model against the data that wasn't used to train the model. So I can link to a page in the show notes for this episode that lists the sensitivity and the specificity for all of the models that we use in bloodsmart.ai. And then in addition to that, Megan mentioned pheno-age. We did a whole podcast on that recently. It's your biological age. So I think that's a really nice marker that you can use to track whether or not the intervention that you're currently working on is making things better or worse. And then we also have the overall wellness score, which is basically your 5-year risk of dying, but we don't call it that because it doesn't sound very nice. I think it's really important to track these things over time. So BloodSmart makes it possible to daisy chain results so that you can track these things over time. And of course, your optimal reference ranges that you did the research on is critically important. I'm still not sure that many people understand. So, you know, when you measure albumin and globulin, like where do those reference ranges come from? Well, it's just a statistical average, typically 2 standard deviations either side of the mean in the data set where the lab is located, right? So that can vary from one lab to the next. And so the reference range can vary from one lab to the next. And the changes are quite wide. And so it's important to have an all-cause mortality-based reference range, which we do for almost all, like there's not a signal there for every single one of the 38 input markers, but you've got optimal reference ranges for everything, right?
Yeah. Some are better. There are more studies for some of them than others. Like you said, there's not a signal for everyone as far as all-cause mortality goes, but absolutely. Yeah, we try to do the best we could. And one thing I wanted to say about the forecasts or predictions, if you want to call them that, is that even if, so say, for example, elevated inorganic mercury comes up, you don't have to jump right to testing. That's a really good conversation starting place where you can ask somebody, do you have mercury amalgams? Or are you eating a lot of high mercury fish? Or if it's lead, are there any potential lead exposures that you can think of? And obviously, some of these things you may not know about. So testing becomes important. And then for the nutrients, you know, you can start asking people about their diet. So it becomes a good conversation starting place as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has happened. We've had clients who are eating a shit ton of sushi and even swordfish, like these really large marine animals that tend to bioaccumulate these metals. And, you know, there's just so many things you could possibly think of. And it just provides a really nice place to sort of start the conversation.
Absolutely. And then other than blood work, there are some tests that not everybody needs, but they can be helpful in certain situations. So for example, an organic acid test, it can look at candida and other microbial overgrowths like Clostridia bacteria. It can look at mitochondrial function or dysfunction. Is probably the best commercially available test we have for mitochondrial function, at least at this time, even though some of the markers aren't perfect. It can look at B vitamin status, which can be a helpful complement for markers like MCV on a blood chemistry. Can also look at detoxification and glutathione status. Then there are like the urinary mycotoxin test that can be helpful in certain situations where maybe mold exposure is suspected, but definitely wouldn't run that on everyone. The Dutch test we already talked about certainly can be helpful in some cases, but trying to fix hormones that don't really need to be fixed is a slippery slope that I prefer not to go down. So I would only run that in certain cases. And then glucose monitoring, we mentioned this before, so with GlycoMark, but a couple of ways that I would recommend monitoring. So you can just do the good old-fashioned handheld glucometer where you test fasting and then maybe like a 1 and 2 hour post-meal. So you can get a nice curve to see what your glucose is doing. Or even better, you can get a continuous glucose monitor. And CGMs are good for trends. They're not perfect, but they can give you a good idea of kind of the variability of your glucose throughout the day. And ideally, what you really want is to do like a CRAF test, which is a kind of an insulin and glucose. It's like an OGG, oral glucose tolerance test. And then they're also looking at insulin at those time marks as well for like 3 hours after the glucose challenge.
And clients seem to really like the continuous glucose monitoring. And we've had lots of really fantastic clients. Just off the top of my head, Douglas Hilbert, Ryan Baxter have been particularly good in sharing their data on our forum and in office hours. And it seems like people universally love the continuous glucose monitoring. I've worn one. I loved it too. Not something I'd need to do forever, but definitely a very interesting experiment.
Yeah. And I think it can give you a lot of good data. You know, if you wear one for 2 weeks, that can give you a lot of great information. And ideally, you know, in the future, it would be great to have like a CGM that can measure glucose and insulin at multiple time points throughout the day. But that technology really isn't there yet.
Right.
Ketone monitoring, some people are really into that. I think it can be helpful for some people, but in most contexts, more ketones aren't always better. And the ketone measurements that we have will tell you next to nothing about ketone metabolism and how ketones are actually being utilized as fuel. They just tell you, you know, how much beta-hydroxybutyrate is in your blood. And then the Cyrex panels, Chris, you mentioned those before, quite expensive, and they can be helpful in rare cases, such as when autoimmunity is kind of suspected, but they're definitely not tests that we're running on a regular basis for everyone. So as we get into like testing in the future, as far as MBT goes, I think we're getting more and more away from testing in many, but not all situations. Empirical protocols can work really well. So I think we've worked with enough clients to know oftentimes what interventions work for the majority of cases and symptoms. So we don't always have to test, at least initially. And that goes oftentimes for like stool tests and gut issues. Blood chemistry is here to stay, I think, forever. Chris, I think you would agree with that. And everything else is kind of optional and case dependent.
I am a big fan of validated learning, though, I have to say. You know, this idea that you test to see where you are and then you make some change and then you test again to see where you are now, right? Like, I think that's a really important way to learn. And, you know, we've talked about that before on the podcast, probably better than the randomized control trial because you don't know how much like you are the people in that trial. And the RCT is really quite terrible for multivariate interventions where they're constantly changing over time. So think about sleep as an example, right? Like, there's just like so many confounding variables. Really difficult to tease apart how you as an individual will respond to a sleep intervention. And so achieving validated learning using one of the biomarkers that we've talked about in this podcast, like continuous glucose monitoring, or maybe your FeNO-Age or something else, I think is going to be really important.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And I know, Chris, you've made some recent software updates.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you want to talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, so I fine-tuned the mercury that's both inorganic, that comes from dental amalgams predominantly. Did you see that the FDA have just done an update on dental amalgams? They've kind of like...
No.
Yeah, so they're like slowly kind of changing their position on dental amalgams. I think up until now, it was always like, oh yeah, there's no problem with those. You don't need to worry about that. And now they're saying that they may be a problem for certain sensitive individuals. That was a press release that just came out last week. I'll link to that in the show notes. Personally, I've removed all my inorganic mercury dental amalgams. And my experience working with clients is dentists are no problem doing that. The dental amalgams are old technology. And my dentist told me that it would eventually split the tooth and that I needed to replace it anyway. And obviously, dentists are obviously quite happy to do the work. But I've also fine-tuned the models for lead and cadmium using raw data that we collected from our MBT clients. So again, it's like somebody already, like you, already did that test. Why are you doing it again? So people in our practice, they ran the Quicksilver Scientific tri-test and we collected the data. And then I retrained the model using that additional data. And I think now we're getting a lower rate of false positives on those models, which is nice. I've also added summary statistics to the health assessment questionnaire. So inside of BloodSmart, you can spend 7 minutes clicking on buttons, and then I will show you your results with the summary statistics so you can see how your subjective life experience compares to other people. So like sleep satisfaction, for example. And I think that's important. I've done the same thing for our 7-minute analysis on the, you can find linked from the front page of our website at nourishbalancethrive.com. And, you know, you spend these 7 minutes clicking on radio buttons, and then I could predict some of the results that we use at MBT using this data. And then the same survey is built into bloodsmart.ai. And I thought it was nice to show the summary statistics because then you can see how you compare to other people. Just like, does my sleep suck like compared to other people like me? And the nice thing about doing it through us is like people like you, right? It's not like the people you see walking down the street because those people are nothing like you. So I think the summary statistics are nice.
Can I just say something about the health assessment questionnaire and those summary statistics? I would really encourage people to do that questionnaire. One, because it helps whoever is looking at your test results, whether that's myself or Chris or another practitioner, it helps them interpret the actual input markers and also the forecasts better. And then also for yourself, Chris has done a nice thing where you can track those symptoms over time.
Right.
And like, I don't remember how I slept or how my gut health was 5 months ago. But if I'm doing another test and I already did the health assessment questionnaire, then it's nice. You can kind of correlate, you know, your wellness score, your pheno age, different markers to how your symptoms are changing over time. So it could be helpful personally too. So I'm a huge fan of the subjective tracking.
We also added high sensitivity C-reactive protein, which is an acute phase reactant, a marker of inflammation, an all-cause mortality-based reference range to BloodSmart. And if you input that directly, then I'll use it for the pheno age calculation. Remember, we talked about pheno age in the previous podcast. And back then, I was using a logistic regression. So, you know, I said before that I can predict the results of a test that you haven't done. And that was what I was doing for the C-reactive protein that goes into the pheno age calculation. Now, you may improve accuracy by entering that value directly. The funny thing is, for most of the people that we see, their CRP is so low that it doesn't really make much difference. But I mean, if you're working with clients that are more in the general population, you're going to see CRP much higher than we normally see it. But we've also got the all-cause mortality reference ranges that Megan researched, which is super helpful. And I also added body measures, weight, height, and waist circumference that you can now put into BloodSmart. And if you give those along with triglycerides and GGT, which is two of the markers on the standard 38 that you can order on the panel through BloodSmart, it's a $71 blood test, then I can calculate the fatty liver index directly. So that was there before as a prediction. I could predict if your fatty liver index was going to be above 60. And above 60 means that you probably do have a fatty liver. Below 60, you probably not. Now I can do the calculation directly because we've got the body measures to complete that calculation. So I'm constantly working on BloodSmart. If you have any ideas for things that I should be working on, then please do get in touch. Just email support@nourishbalancethrive.com. I'd love to hear your feedback, particularly if you've got a pain point, you know, like something that really sucks for you, that sucks every day, then I would love to hear about that. Just drop us an email, support@nourishbalancethrive.com.
All right. Anything else on testing, Chris? I think we covered a lot. I think that the moral of the story is that blood work will kind of always stay and everything else is optional and context dependent.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's just about it. We've covered a lot of ground and no doubt we will continue to evolve and we should do this podcast again at some point in the future where we talk about the other things that we've learned along the way because I think sharing that information is important.
Absolutely.
And so if you've already got some test results and you'd like Megan to take a look at them, why not come to the front page of our website, nourishbalancethrive.com. You'll find a button there. You can book a free 15-minute starter session. You can talk to Megan and you can tell us a little bit about your history. We'll take a look at your data. And then we'll share how we might work with you as part of our elite performance program. We've changed the way that we bill. You know, we used to do the super expensive program that Megan alluded to earlier, where it was $10,000, which was obviously quite a large financial commitment. We've changed that now. We do a $1,500 retainer and then we charge an hourly rate. Everything comes out of the retainer and then we just auto rebuild the retainer if necessary. And again, I think this is lowering the risk to you as a potential client because you can come in, we can just run a blood test. We can take a look at the results and you can say, no, yeah, that looks fine to me. And we'll just refund the rest of your retainer and call it good. There's not much of an obligation there. So if you're interested in that, come to the front page of our website, nourishbalancethrive.com, and you'll find a button there to book a free starter session for our elite performance program. Well, Megan, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and effort putting this outline together. Thank you.
Of course. It was good to talk to you, Chris.
Cheers.